Reset the podcast is brought to you in association with Liars, the non-alcoholic spirits brand. Whether it's low alcohol or no alcohol, Liars helps you enjoy your classic favourite cocktails.
Hello everyone, my name is Suki Thompson. Welcome to Reset the podcast. A place for you to get some inspiration and advice to help you live a more fulfilling work life. I do hope that your journey to feel more connected, more inspired, just a bit more energized starts here. Take a moment now with me to reset. Martin George is a man with a very real story to tell. From his amazing career at British Airways and Marketing Concord, through to his five-year wait for a very public court case. Through it all, he learned the power of resilience and to focus on what really matters. He chats to me about both these things in this Reset podcast. As the Chief Customer Officer at Waitrose now, Martin also explains how he's a passionate advocate for the importance of well-being, culture, and looking after your teams as well as your customer.
Hi Martin, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you, Suki. Very good. Thank you very much for inviting me to do this. I hope you're well too.
I'm very well, thank you. And I am drinking. We were just saying this. I am drinking a Liars gin and tonic at 10:30 in the morning.
that's hardcore, Suki.
Which is hardcore, except it's non-alcoholic. But I thought about you that, you know, a kind of gin and tonic sort of sums up our long-term standing relationship that we've had for, a really long time now. But you're not drinking, are you? So Liars is kind of good for you.
Yeah, no, Liars is very good for me. So yeah, I think one of the things that's happened during lockdown is that I was told early on that you're likely to become a chunk, a hunk or a drunk. And I figured that I could become at least two of those. So I have very consciously exercised quite a lot. I have very consciously not been drinking during lockdown. And actually, we're also not eating meat. So it's been three quite big changes in my life over the last 6 months, really just to help manage the physical and mental challenges of lockdown.
Wow. Well, actually, that's quite a big reset then, isn't it?
So it's a big reset.
A big reset. We've started already. So that's what we're going to talk about today. So I first met you when you were at BA, but before that, I think you were at Cadbury's. How did you get to that? Did you go to university? How did you get to Cadbury's?
Yes, so I went to Loughborough University, really to play sport. I did a management degree, but really I went there to play squash. The course was fantastic, really great. And probably the best thing about it was that I spent a year working at Boots in Nottingham. And I worked in the home winemaking and brewing department. And I bought everything from Demijohns to home winemaking kit. And I came out of Boots, which was a brilliant place to work, concluding that I wanted to work in marketing. So I focused my final year of study on marketing, and particularly marketing of services for that matter. And then I was fortunate enough to get onto the Cadbury graduate scheme. And Cadbury's were absolutely brilliant. The scheme was fantastic. I spent some time in the sales force. I was absolutely hopeless in the sales force. Absolutely clueless. Just useless. So, it starts from the fact that I did the company driving test, and I hadn't driven a car from being 17 to that day. And I got in the car with the other graduates and the driving instructor. And we proceeded to drive around Birmingham, and I hadn't driven for, 4 years? And I was useless, absolutely hopeless. And anyway, installed it in the middle of Birmingham. It was a disaster. And we got back to Cadbury's head office. And I remember this to my dying day. The instructor said, "I've never failed anybody, but you were the closest I've ever seen." And of course, the graduates who I started with just thought this was like the best day of their lives. They just ribbed me for the whole time I was at Cadbury's. But Cadbury's were brilliant. I basically spent the time living in guest houses and hotels and selling chocolate. I was selling chocolate in Brighton in the middle of the summer. You can imagine how well that went. And my boss, who clearly thought I was hopeless, was just proved right. So as soon as I could get out of the sales force into the comfort of the marketing department, I grabbed that opportunity. Mm-hmm. And Cadbury's was just a fantastic place to work, and believed very much in giving people early accountability and really trusting people and empowering them. And I worked with some great people, I worked on some great brands, and I learned a huge amount.
That's so interesting. You use words trust, empowerment. Having known you and worked with you for a number of years, those two words really, to me, sum up what you're like. You expect people to be trusting of you, but also you give people a lot of trust and empowerment. Is that where you learnt those sort of management skills, or did you get that from when you were young?
So I've been blessed in that I've worked for some truly exceptional leaders, and that started very early on. So I can remember the people I worked for at Boots, and this is quite a long time ago, in that that sandwich year. And they were just great people. And they gave me the right amount of space, the right amount of coaching, so that I learned a lot, but I couldn't do myself or the business any serious harm. And that continued when I joined British Airways. Again, I can remember the people that I worked for and the difference that they made to my life. And I've tried to learn from those and then very much embrace that way of working as I've become a leader.
And when I first met you at British Airways, in fact, I met you at the MGGB, which is a marketing group of Great Britain, one of our industry groups. You went on to be, are you called the president when you kind of run the MGGB?
Oh, I don't know. He's chairman, I think, isn't it?
Chairman,
something like that, whatever, yeah.
Chairman,
yeah.
President, I think you were presidential anyway. And I remember writing you an email going, oh, I see that you're going to change your agency. And it had been a massively long-standing relationship for a long, long time with M&C Saatchi. I said, I'm sure you might need some help, Martin. And you went, oh, I think I'm absolutely fine. And then the next day you turned up and you went, actually, I think a little bit of help would be good. And it was a tsunami of agencies just kind of, you know, all over BA at this prospect of winning the business. But you loved BA for a lot of your time. What was it like working there in the kind of, you know, in the middle of all that amazing time?
It was wonderful. BA was a wonderful place to work, and I loved so much of it. I mean, virtually all of the time I was there was just an absolute joy. And many people that I worked with were there a long time. And used to say, well, so why is it that everybody stays such a long time at British Airways? And the answer was typically, well, when times are good, there's nothing like it. And when times are bad, you think, well, I can't leave because people might think that it's my fault. And as a result, everybody stayed for a long time. But it was an absolute joy to work with some amazing people who've gone on to do so well. You know, so I look at people like Chris Jansen, or I look at people like, you know, Jill McDonald, with a huge sense of admiration for what they've achieved. And you could see, you know, when they were much earlier in their careers, the potential that they had. BA was a magnet for talent, and we were very, very fortunate. And also, I think largely because of Colin Marshall's leadership, it was a business that was very, very brave. So we did market-changing things, and that was a very exciting place to be. It put a huge amount of investment into genuine innovation, and, you know, doing the kind of jobs that we do. That's really exciting. So it was absolutely customer obsessed. And we would do everything we possibly could to serve our customers brilliantly. And that's a great environment to be in. It's invigorating, it's energizing, it's inspiring, and it's great fun. You know, so I remember on my very first day as marketing director there, just to give you a small example, Bob Ayling, who was the chief executive, he walked into my office, this was before open plan days, with a huge picture of what turned out to be the London Eye. And he gave me this picture and he said, oh, that's for your wall. I said, oh, that's great. I said, you know, that's super. Where is that? He said, no, it doesn't exist. He said, but that's a project that together we're going to deliver. And then, you know, roll the clock forward. And that's what happened.
Wow.
And, you know, and who would have thought that an airline, you know, we put fourth class across our entire fleet. We obviously put flatbeds into business class. We've had arrivals lounges. We did wellbeing in the air. And we changed the uniforms twice with Julie McDonald once and Paul Costello another time. I mean, kind of anything was possible. Yeah. And it was just it was a really invigorating time to be at British Airways. I absolutely loved it.
And also, you know, it was a time when flying was kind of sexy and fun and business, as you say, you know, flatbeds in business. And, you know, we were similar at our times of career where if we could go business class, let alone first class, to go on doing an ad shoot or, you know, a marketing trip or whatever we were doing was kind of super sexy. But you guys were flying around all over the place, weren't you?
Oh, I mean, looking back, when I tell my kids, I mean, it was crazy. We would take clients to New York for the day on Concorde. So it sounds ridiculously glamorous. And of course, at the time it was, but we'd meet at Heathrow. We'd have breakfast at Heathrow. We'd get on the Concorde and we would have a couple of hours meeting at JFK in New York. And then we would get on Concorde and fly back. And I'd land back and be home by 11 o'clock in the evening. So you had basically had a very long working day and you'd been to New York and back. And you'd go off and do conferences in all four corners of the world, meet the most amazing people and see the most amazing sights. So it was an extraordinary time. And that's one of the reasons it was probably the time when I fell in love with travel. And just it was wonderful. Yeah. And I think, you know, I really hope the travel industry comes back in its full pomp because and I really hope people get a chance to enjoy it in the way that that I did and my generation did, because it was really, really special.
Yeah, absolutely. Really special. But then it stopped quite suddenly, didn't it? Because there was the press coverage that, you know, we only saw from the outside of something to do, we thought, with price fixing, to do with passionate. We didn't really know what it was. But it sort of felt like it went deep into BA, and the result was you left pending a number of years later a court incident where you had to go to court, and actually it was thrown out immediately. So you were never guilty or found guilty, but that moment of going from somewhere which was extraordinarily an amazing place to being out of that in a pretty public way, what did that feel like?
It was extremely traumatic at the time. And it's sort of, I smile when I hear you describe it, because that feels like it was somebody else. It doesn't feel like it was me. But at the time, it was traumatic. As you say, one minute you are a commercial director of a global airline, you know, the world's favorite airline. And then you and a number of other people are accused of something that you know for certain you're not guilty of. And then you lose control. And you've been in a situation in your job where you've been in control of virtually everything, because you'd had to be. And suddenly you were out of control. And I remember at the time somebody saying to me, Martin, you need to be ready. This could take a year to get sorted. And it took 5 years. And it was 5 years of anxiety, 5 years of stress, 5 years of not knowing what was going to happen. And that puts enormous pressure on you as an individual. But in some ways, you kind of accept that, because that kind of in some ways comes with the job. But what really troubles you is seeing the impact on the people around you, seeing the impact on my wife, on my children, on my parents, and on our friends. And I mean, certainly it had a big bearing on the health and of my parents for a while. I remember, you know, my mother in particular struggled with it, as you might expect. And 5 years is a long time.
Yeah.
And you know, that was it. Justice delayed is justice denied, and that's how it felt. It really felt difficult to think about how you could get on with your life with this black cloud hanging over us. So, I look back on it as, they say what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. And whilst that's a sort of throwaway comment and often used for issues that are not quite as serious as the ones we're talking about, there is some truth in it. So I know that I can cope with stress, and I know those around me can. And it's made me focus on what really matters. It's made me more determined. I think it's made me more sympathetic and empathetic and more thoughtful. I mean, the thing about being a marketing director or commercial director at British Airways, it's quite easy to lose a sense of reality. I mean, we just talked about some examples of how I lost the sense of reality. And you get to meet all sorts of really interesting people who at the time you might think are your friends. You go to and actually, not surprisingly, these are all things that come with the job, you know, and you just happen to be the temporary, holder of that post, really, the temporary custodian of that post. But it is quite easy to mix those two things up. When you have a grounding exit, and what you realise is that if you're not careful, your job defines you, and it can define you entirely. It can define you completely. And when you're working the hours that, you know, many of us work, and when you're not working, you're thinking about work. And when you're not working, you are enjoying the benefits of working. Your job's defining you in every possible sense. You know, where you go, who you're with, who you know, what you eat, where you live, etc. And when you have a really grounding experience like that, it encourages you, it forces you to think about who you really are. When you strip away all of that packaging that comes with a job, with a role, who is the real person? What is the real person? What do you stand for? What matters to you?
And what did you think that was? What did it make you realize about yourself?
Well, again, I apologize if this is a cliche, but what it caused me to recognize was that I'd spent my entire career up until that point thinking about, runs on the board, thinking about effectively the ability to assume and collect material possessions. You know, that actually the aspiration was always to get a bigger job, get more senior, earn more money. At least, I mean, I'm not materialistic actually in the slightest, ironically, but actually at least having the ability, having the option to buy stuff. What I recognized, and maybe I was just slow to realize this, was actually those things really beyond a point don't really matter. I mean, I know there's lots of academic research that says beyond a certain income level, your satisfaction in life, you know, doesn't increase materially. That all feels great to hear, but then you think, yeah, but that doesn't apply to me, actually. I still want more. I still want different. But this experience taught me that that's absolutely right. And it just reminded me, there are a couple of occasions in life when I prioritized work over something important in my personal life. And I will never forgive myself for that. Never forgive myself. I mean, there's the obvious things like, you know, kids, you know, Christmas events or, you know, end of year celebrations or things like that, where I might be on a trip and I might, for some deluded reason, think actually that's more important, or I can't, this possibly can't possibly happen if I'm not there. And actually, you know, I'll never get those times back. And there's one particular occasion, and I'd probably rather not go into the detail, where something really tragic happened to my best friend. And he needed me, he and his wife needed me. And I was doing something with work. And, you know, afterwards I said to him, I'll never forgive myself for that. That was absolutely unforgivable. At that moment in time, I had lost any sense of what mattered.
Yeah.
That I thought anything work-related could be more important than looking after, you know, my closest friend in his moments of need. I mean, that's something. And if ever I sort of get slightly caught up again with that, I just have that moment and I just step back and think, no, you've learned your lesson. You know, make sure that's a lesson for life.
Yeah. And I think you're right. Look, I'm sure I've certainly been in that place. And you look back and you just go, why did I think that was so important? And it does. And in a way, it's quite nice, bizarrely, I think, that it happens early-ish in your career, or certainly at a time where you have more of your career afterwards, that you can be, you know, kind of more true, more authentic, make those right decisions, I think. You know, because it does make a difference. And I think, you know, certainly the way that you are held with such love and respect within business and with the industry, you know, it's a lot to do with the kind of person you are and the, you know, the way that you look after people and lead people and care, you know, which I think is great.
Well, it's very nice of you to say that. And I think a lot of that is down to the experience that I had and the time I had to reflect on what really matters. And also just, you know, increasingly recognizing that, you know, people look at their leaders for clues and cues as to how you should behave and, you know, and what's acceptable. And, you know, and it's interesting, you know, I think one of the things I've learned in time, for example, is the importance of showing vulnerability. And, you know, and I think it's absolutely fascinating that, you know, it's a bit like being a parent. There's a sort of assumption that in every circumstance you've got the answer. And actually, if your team think that's true, in some ways it inhibits their ambition because they think, gosh, well, I don't have the answer to every problem, so I can't possibly do a job like that. When they hear you say, well, I don't know, let's talk about it and we'll work out the answer together. People think, I could do that. I can do that. I can get a group of people in a room and we can all chat about our respective opinions and we can reach consensus. I can do that. So I think that kind of, you know, showing that you don't have all the answers, showing that at times you do feel some degree of anxiety or worry or concern, it just makes you more human, makes you, and it's just much more authentic and it's just much more believable.
Yeah. And I think that more human, I think, you know, for me, one of the very special moments of our friendship, business friendship, was I, at Oyster Catchers, I don't even know if you remember this, at Oyster Catchers, I had a bit of a run-in with Martin Sorrell.
I do remember.
You do. And he, you know, you say it's interesting when you have a bit of a run-in, whatever environment, you suddenly see who your friends really are. And you were one of those people who picked up the phone and said, I know you feel in a different way. If there's anything I can do, I've got a checkbook here. I can write you a check to help you out a bit, you know, and there were a few people like that. And for me, that was such an extraordinary thing to do and made me feel so much better. And as it was, we found a way around and it was okay. And we paid the money and actually it made the business much stronger and certainly me stronger as a leader. But that moment when you reached out to me was very special. So thank you for that.
Not at all. That's what friends are all about, isn't it? I mean, I think when you see people in difficulty, it's often easier for you not to reach out and say, look, I don't want to interfere. You know, I don't want to get involved. I'm sure they're handling it themselves. And actually, in times of difficulty, it can be very, very lonely. And what I found in my very difficult period was out of 1,000 people, I would say 999 amazed me in a positive way. You know, the one or two people that were sort of slightly let us down. But actually, you know, I don't bear any grudge or even think about that. What I think about is the people that I either hardly knew or didn't know who emailed me or rang me and just said, if there's anything I can do to help, just let me know. And people went to extraordinary lengths just to say, look, we're here for you. And I feel like for the rest of my life, there is a degree to which I need to pay that back to those individuals, but also to society at large, which is why when somebody says, I'd really like your help, I'll do anything I can to help them. Anything.
Which is amazing and brilliant. It also, you know, it's the time, and you were then working at Bupa during that time, and again, we were working together. I remember you talking to me about, you know, beginning to do more exercise, looking after your mental health to get you through that period. I know, you know, you said you were very sporty when you were younger, played squash, but really kind of taking that part of your life very seriously. You know, exercise, I know, has been important. What sort of other things have you done for your mental well-being?
Well, I'm very fortunate. I mean, in that my wife's a nutritionist. So what we eat has been something we've always taken a lot of care over. I mean, it helps when you work for Waitrose, of course. But in all seriousness, that's something that I think really, really matters. So I wouldn't say we are extreme, but it's something we're very, you know, we're very thoughtful about. So I think that really helps. Spending time with family and friends is really, really important. I mean, my parents, Helen, my wife's parents, have always been brilliantly supportive of us as a couple and us as a family. And that family time is really important. You know, when my family lived just outside York, and to be honest, it frankly doesn't matter to them what I do, you know, work-wise. Whenever we go up and see them, we'll spend about 2 minutes talking about my job. And then we're talking about, you know, everything else. And that's just brilliant. So they're very grounding. You know, my parents, you know, they and my brother, they take the mickey out of me. They, you know, we do out of each other. You know, it's a very loving and caring and supportive family. And as you say, yeah, lots of exercise. So I love exercise. Sleep really matters. You know, sleep, you know, downtime, just downtime generally. And I love very normal TV. I mean, Coronation Street is the love of my life. I've been watching Coronation Street since I was a child, and I am completely up to date with Coronation Street. I'm partly embarrassed to say, but you know, things like that. I love TV. I'll go into the cinema or go into as light relief. My wife's the sort of more intellectual. I like, you know, Made in Chelsea, Selling Sunset. You know, that's kind of my cup of tea. That is where I get my, you know, downtime and get my release. So those kind of things really matter. But I think for me, a bit like you need to consciously plan what you do at work, you need to consciously plan this. And you need to look for the warning signs that you've got your life out of balance. And if you're waking up at 3 o'clock in the morning and your head's full of work, then you know, just facing into that and being conscious of it and doing something about it. So I think what I've learned over time is I can see the warning signs. I can feel the warning signs that things are out of kilter. And I know what I need to do to try and redress the balance. Not always. So, you know, I have a sort of rule that 12 weeks is the maximum that you can work full on without some form of break, or whether the break's just a long weekend or a day off. And I think, you know, it's very tempting to say, look, I don't need a holiday. You know, I can just power on. But we haven't been away and we this year because of, you know, everything that we've all been through. And I know that I'm not performing on top of my game. I know that I'm tired. I know that I'm grumpy. I know my team probably feel I'm expressing my frustration more visibly than normal. And that's a warning sign. Now, you know, we're a couple of weeks away from having some time off, but under normal circumstances, I wouldn't allow that to happen because I know that I'm not, you know, doing what I need to do as a, you know, as a leader. So I think just listening to yourself and watching, you know, your internal dials to see whether they're going into red, that's something which I'm very conscious of.
Yeah, I can see that. I can see that. And I definitely agree. I do think taking time off, proper time off. I think because I've run businesses myself and built them up for so long, that temptation to not take proper holiday is quite acute because it's always about trying to build and you don't have that same discipline of holiday. Mm. And I always thought that it sort of didn't really matter because I loved what I did so much.
Yeah.
But actually, it really, really does. And I think then the other thing was, you know, during lockdown, we did some Let's Reset. We did a couple of workshops for John Lewis Waitrose. And they really struck out to me that they're very memorable. We had about 100 people each time. So they were very big, which was an amazing experience on Zoom. You attended. And there really were very few. We trained about 2,500 people during lockdown. And you and one other very senior person in a different organization were the two people that struck me that they sat through these sessions, they listened, they participated, and it makes a very big difference to the people. But there was this one lovely moment where, and I won't say her name, I'll call her Jackie. But Jackie was feeling a bit down and was worried about kind of not engaging and been on furlough, and another girl had dropped her off some chocolate brownies. And Jackie had said, you know, and so we were asking, you know, what lovely things had happened during lockdown. And so yeah. Jackie said, well, Belinda had dropped me off some chocolate brownies on a Sunday and I was feeling particularly bad and low and alone. And Belinda said, oh, I didn't realise that. Oh, well, I'm glad you like the chocolate brownies. You know, you're very special and you're an important part of the team, which was a lovely thing. But the bit that happened next was the bit that struck me, which was then everyone piled in with amazing things to say about Jackie.
Yeah,
about
great.
You know what she was like and why she was important to the team and the kind of role she had and why they missed her. And I thought that that really gave a sense of the kind of culture that you've created there, the team dynamic, that one, they felt open enough to do it, but actually that's what they wanted to do. They wanted to care more than just it's a job or it's a kind of conversation. It was it was really thoughtful, and I thought that was a lovely thing.
Well, it's a lovely story. I mean, it's interesting because you know this, Suki. I'd always wanted to work for the partnership, and when I got the opportunity to be customer director at Waitrose, I grabbed it with both hands, and I was absolutely fascinated by what it was about the culture in the organisation that allowed the business to enable the business to deliver such great service in store, typically. And there is something very, very special about the culture in the organisation. That hasn't happened overnight. It's been there for a long, long time. And people really do care about each other. It's not superficial. It's genuine. It's really authentic. And I feel that it's not something that just happens, you know, it happens at all levels and across the hierarchy and across geography. It's really, really special. And I suspect there are fewer businesses now that have that strength of culture than did maybe 10 or 20 years ago. Yeah. But it's very powerful and it makes it a great place to work.
Thank you, Martin. Lovely to talk to you today. Thank you for sharing your reset moments. I think I love the expression, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. You have certainly shown that you are a really strong leader. You're an amazing man and I'm very proud and pleased that you're my friend as well. So thank you, Martin.
An absolute pleasure, Suki. Catch you soon. Thanks ever so much.
See you soon. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. If you've enjoyed Reset the Podcast, I'd love it if you would forward it to your work colleagues, friends, and family. Reset the Podcast is a Let's Reset and Advertising Week global production. Executive producer is Richard Larson, with me, Suki Thompson. Thanks to our sponsor, Liars Non-Alcoholic Spirits, and voiceover artist, Talitha Penny. Music provided by Audio Network.